This is the Press Pass with Chris Ryan.
This is where you hear unique conversations with the best athletes, coaches, and general managers in sports.
I think you appreciate each and every one. Each and every one is special in their own way. And
I play with two guys that they were on top of their game on a nightly basis, and people get spoiled. You know, they saw Manny, they saw David, so they start taking people for granted.
An opportunity for me. I know I need to help my team now, so you know, the better I play, the better it'll be for us.
I think it's one of the most important
Welcome
things.
Welcome to the Press Pass here on KXL 199, 1450 and NHTalkRadio.com. This is the show all about New England and New Hampshire sports. It's presented by Douglas, Leonard & Garvey. If you've been injured, the most important decision you're going to make is who your lawyer is going to be. I encourage you to check out Douglas, Leonard & Garvey at NHLawOffice.com. And this segment of the show is brought to you by the Prescription Center, where the health of you and your family comes first. More information, check out prescription-center.com. A lot to talk about on the show here tonight. The Red Sox, for some inexplicable reason, continue to entertain trading Mookie Betts, which is just mind-boggling. We'll get to that with our resident sports expert Dave D'Onofrio in just a little bit here on the program. UNH hockey coach Mike Souza will join us as well. The Wildcats are worthy of your attention. They're a winning hockey team for the first time in a bit, and not necessarily back to the championship caliber hockey team that we remember. But Souza's doing a good job building the program back up. We'll talk with him in just a little bit. We'll take a look at the Celtics as well, as the Celtics have bounced back after losing 6 of 8 games with 2 impressive wins, and they're on a 3-game road trip, and the Bruins have hit the All-Star break as well. With the second most points in the National Hockey League. But you wouldn't know it, though, because a lot of the coverage and feel around the Bruins is pretty negative. But, again, they have the second most points in the National Hockey League, just behind Washington, who has 71. Bruins have 70 points, and most of the feeling around the Bruins is that they're, you know, underachieving, and I definitely don't feel that's the case. They've left some points on the table. There's no question about that, the way they've played in overtime and how they've done the shootout, but Bruins are pretty good. Celtics are 29-14. And are fourth currently in the Eastern Conference, but just a game and a half back of the very surprising Miami Heat, who are 31-13. Celtics will see them at in the last game of this 3-game road trip. But a lot of the talk around the Celtics has centered around the center position and whether or not they need to upgrade there. I feel that Enes Kanter has been really good for the Celtics and is an asset for the team. However, Kendrick Perkins floated that Celtics maybe need to trade Gordon Hayward for Steven Adams, which has been rumored. I don't know if it has to be Hayward, but I do feel the Celtics need a quality big to start games or come off the bench. I mean, Kanter could start. I don't really care. I think that the Tice is a good player, but I feel that he is a backup and perhaps more of a depth guy than a rotation guy. And that needs to be something the Celtics need to address here moving forward. I like that. And also like to see a shooter come off the bench. Those are two areas where I think the Celtics need to go. I don't think that, you know, I think that Enes Kanter is a very valuable player for the Celtics, and he has played much better as of late. My question is more about Tice and, you know, whether he is a definite rotation guy. I mean, you look at Enes Kanter's numbers this year, shooting 60% from the field. He is at 18.5 minutes per game, 9.5 points, and 8.2 rebounds per game. So the rebound numbers are really, really good, and he's particularly good on the offensive glass. I talked with Celtics big Enes Kanter about that.
One of your biggest attributes is the offensive rebound. What goes into making sure that you have success in that area? What makes you good at it?
I will say it's an effort thing, but I have no idea, man. I feel like it's a God's gift, you know, because it's just offensive rebound is all about effort, and I kind of know where the ball's going to go before it touches the rim. So it just ball just kind of comes more automatically. So it's not like I'm working hard for it too, obviously, but like I just kind of know like where the ball's going to go.
It's one of the things, like defensive rebounding is effort. Like you're getting your positioning.
Defense effort, for sure.
Right, but offensive rebounding, how do you judge? Like you mentioned, you kind of know where it's going. Do you judge shooters? Do you judge where the ball's coming in?
It's not like I'm the most athletic guy in the team or in the league. I kind of like, I just stand there. Ball just comes and finds me. I swear, I have no idea how. They've been asking me that the last 8 years, and I still couldn't answer it. I have no idea, but I'll just say it's a God's gift.
In terms of finding yourself within this team, you've had a great couple of weeks here. What has led to your comfort?
I will say confidence. Obviously, whenever I'm out there, my team has given me a lot of confidence. And obviously, with that injury I had beginning of the season, it did affect me a lot. But now I just feel more comfortable out there, not just offensively, defensively too.
Do you have, when you come to a new team, like feelings about the way certain guys are? And I'm curious as to like what you thought about Kemba prior to him coming in here and what you noticed.
I knew, obviously, it was in my draft class. I know he was an amazing player, but I didn't know he was that humble and down-to-earth guy. I mean, obviously, this guy is an all-star, makes crazy money, and then he's like a superstar. He is the face of this, one of the face of this franchise, but like he's always nice, always smiling, always positive, and always, just keeping the team together and a very down-to-earth guy.
Does, particularly for a veteran like you, do you take cues from a guy like Kemba or from leadership guys on the team? When they act a certain way or they are a certain way, do they set the tone for the locker room?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Obviously, when you see a guy like Kemba or Marcus or Gordon, like, staying this humble, always hungry, always hardworking, it sets an example for young guys, too.
All right, Celtics center Enes Kanter right there. And I took in a pretty interesting event. It was the first time I've ever been to a professional bull riding event. And it was down in Manchester, the SNHU Arena. And these guys are... You could, make an argument for UFC fighters, but these guys, to me, are the toughest athletes that you will find. And I don't think there's much question. I mean, if you're a fighter, you fight, like, a couple times a year. These guys do it every weekend, and they get thrown from bulls, like, twice or three times a night. And each time, you are taking your life in your hands, because if you come down... and the bull comes down on your face or on your neck or somewhere that area, you're done. And I don't know if it's bravery or if it's something else, but these guys are the toughest that you will find. You think about the neck, the back injuries that they go through each week, and there is that aspect of just kind of getting up too. That's a part of the cowboy culture. We talked with Cody Nance, one of the top guys on the circuit, joined me in studio on my New Hampshire Now show. The top 35 bull riders in the world are part of this this tour. How does the how does it work? How do you get to this point? Like, is there a minor leagues? Like, how does it get determined how you get selected to be one of the top 35?
Well, you don't really get selected. You get you just have to qualify. There's a
Like a tryout,
level.
Or
yeah, well, there's another level that you have to compete in, and you have to buy your card. You have to be 18 to get your card. You have to pay an entry fee. You have to win money in place to establish some world points. And once you established enough world points, you're competing for that. The bottom five positions on this tour. They're going to change them out every few weeks.
Okay,
and if you're in that bottom five, and you need to establish some points because somebody's ready to take your spot. This isn't really one of those sports where you get a salary and you get chose to ride on this tour and happy ever after. No, it's you work to get there and you work to stay there. And if you don't, then if you don't compete to the top, your ability, then you get cut off tour. Nobody remembers who you are.
that's interesting because, there's a lot of discussion about how the four major sports work in this country. And soccer, say the English Premier League, like if you finish in the bottom four, you can drop out. And then the top four in the second league can move up into the Premier League. And that's like unheard of in professional sports where teams like tank in order to try to get top draft choices. But if you finished in the bottom four of the NFL and you dropped out of the NFL, and these are the four teams moved in, I think that would make things a lot more interesting. But obviously it's stressful for you because you have to, if you don't perform and you don't, do your best, you could end up not on the tour anymore. And the dream is dissipating.
Yeah, it's one of those things that, I've been cut off the tour one time since 2009, And it was because I had a knee injury, and I just wouldn't take a break. I didn't use my exemptions to try to heal up. I just kept going, and I wasted it. But once I got down on that lower level and I had done experienced that, I said, no, I'm not going to stay here. I know where I belong. And I just went and I hustled, and I got back on pretty quick. Won an event when I first got on, seated me for the finals. So, I mean, it's kind of that mentality you got to have, and I think that be cowboy mentality is everywhere. I don't care where you are, because, you know, if you're a policeman or a firefighter or whatever your job is, and, you know, a radio host, you got to do, you got to be cowboy and do is that, you know, it's that mentality that we look at, you know, that keeps us going, that keeps us driven, and you know, keeps the sport alive.
That's Cody Nance joining us here on the New Hampshire Now program. This hour of the show is presented by Dennehy and Boulay, and this segment of the program is brought to you by Loon Mountain. So you don't have to watch bull riding for very long on television to know that bull riders are, if not the toughest, close to the toughest athletes that you will find. The amount of, you know, beating that you take in trying to stay on the bull, let alone trying what happens if you get thrown off the bull, is flat out amazing. So how do you deal with those types of injuries? Because you have to, whether it's a neck injury or back injury, like that's a kind of a given, I would assume, that you're going to have some sort of a neck or back injury. And how do you deal with it?
Well, I mean, you know, bull riding is a rough sport. Absolutely. You're riding a 1,300 pound animal all the way up. He could weigh 2,500 pounds. I got on a 3-year-old in Canada a couple of years ago that weighed 23, I think. My goodness, these animals are so strong and athletic. They're bred to do what they do. I mean, people think that, you know, we prong them or electrocute them or make them do something, you know, but they don't. We don't. We just get on them and they do it themselves. This is what they're bred to do. If their bull made it to this level, it's kind of like your son making it to the NFL. And, you know, if, I don't know. It takes a lot of training for us to be able to go out there and continue to do what we do week in, week out. A lot of rehab, you know, because, I mean, we're getting thrown around. You can't avoid having to get off. So, I mean, that's right. Not always going to be a pleasant experience. You know, you can bang a knee up just stepping off of one on your feet, you know. So you got to you really got to put that stuff out of your mind. Each time you get on your back of one of them animals, something's going to be sore.
So how do you do that? Like, how do you put it out of your mind that there's a very good chance I'm going to have a serious injury here?
Well, I mean, you think about what you've done to prepare yourself for this event, for, you know, this ride, and mentally you got to do that the same as your body. Your brain is kind of like your muscle, and, you know, that you have to train, and, you know, you just got to be courageous. I'm a man of faith. I believe that God protects me, and has gotten me everything I have, and I'm just thankful that, you know, I've been able to have a career this long, and I've experienced so much through it, and, you know, it's something that I'm very, very passionate about. I enjoy the sport, but I enjoy what it's given me as far as the mentality goes. You know, I can do anything from here on. I don't think there's anything that could stop me. You know what I mean? Yeah. And I think you got to train your mind to think that way, because a lot of times you see somebody that's spoon-fed and handed everything. Right. They don't know what to do with it.
Right. So you mentioned you grew up on a horse farm, and you obviously, when you're riding horses, you have a relationship with that animal. You know what they're going to do. It's a very, you know, there's that knowledge and understanding.
Yeah.
So the bulls, do you know anything about them when you're getting it? Nothing. So you
sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. But I mean, if you try to make a prediction and set yourself up, you know, I mean, there's counterweight. Their bulls, he's moving forward, you got to reach forward. He's moving to the left, you got to move to the left a little bit. You can't go too far, because he can feel a fly on his back and shake him loose. And if he feels you move over there, then he can obviously go the other direction. You need to be able to relax, clear your mind, ride him jump for jump. And, you know, it's kind of like a dance, but you got to let him lead.
That's funny. So take us through, like, what is going to be taking place in Manchester over the 2 days. There's two events taking place. There's one on Saturday. That's, I think, at around 6:45, and then 1:45 on Sunday. Yeah, so take us through what's going to take place.
So you're going to have the top 35 guys competing each night. What you're going to see there is the guys are – let me explain the points a little bit so that you know what's going on. There's 100 points available. The bull, he has half the points. The rider has half the points. The bull is going to be judged on how high he jumps in the air, how fast he spins, how hard he kicks his back legs. All that's going to go into play there. And then the bull rider that is on the back of him is going to be judged based on his style, his ability to stay in control and to try to maybe loosen up and get some extra points, show the judge that he's dominating the ride.
How would you describe, you know, the experience of bull riding? And, you know, you mentioned the mental aspect of it, but how about from a, you know, from an adrenaline perspective? How would you describe that? And is there anything in your view that, you know, that replicates what it is like to have that type of the strength of that animal? You're in this kind of dance with it, as you referenced, where you're trying to figure out, you know, how to position yourself so that you can stay on for as long as possible. How would you describe it?
Growing up, I tried a lot of different things to give me that adrenaline rush. But once I got on the back of one of them animals, I just knew that was for me. There was nothing I experienced, and nothing I have experienced since has given me the rush like I have had on the back of one of them animals. I mean, when you are able to dominate the ride, it feels so good. I mean, everything is in motion. It feels like you're on top of the world when you step off of that thing. And, you know, I mean, I think if you're passionate about something and you accomplish, you know, your goal, then you get that feeling. It's just very, very fulfilling. I appreciate the sport. I appreciate what all I have to, you know, I'm able to do that helps me keep going. You know, I'm thankful for my health, everything that I have, and these bulls and the PBR, and my goodness, it's just been an amazing journey. I can't tell you how much fun it's been, you know, to ride these bulls, and as long as I've been able to do it, I feel very, very blessed. I mean, they're jumping and spinning and kicking in the air, and you just get up there and take the power away from them with, you know, you got to be in control, and that's how you get your points. You can't just be hanging off the side. And but I tell you what, if you do get out of shape and you're hanging off the side, they're strong, and there's not much more you can do other than hang on and until they rip that glove or the rope out of your glove.
That's professional bull rider Cody Nance. This is the Press Pass on KXL. This is the Press Pass here on KXL tonight, presented by Douglas Leonard and Garvey. This segment of the show brought to you by Riverbend Community Mental Health and Choices, NH Addiction Recovery Services. Riverbend wants you to know that treatment works. As we welcome in right now to talk some Red Sox, as the Red Sox, for some inexplicable reason, are continuing to walk down the path of trading Mookie Betts. We'll also talk about the Hall of Fame as well, as welcome in our resident sports expert, Dave D'Onofrio. Dave, how are you?
Doing good, thank you.
Good, appreciate you joining us for the show. Let's start with this. Red Sox are rumored to be still discussing trades for Mookie Betts. And I've talked about this before. The effect that the Red Sox will see in trading Mookie Betts is such a significant negative impact, where it will signal that the Red Sox are turning the page on being a championship caliber team. And I think in an era where baseball is struggling to gain and retain fandom, they may lose not a generation of fans, but they'll lose a significant amount of young fans and fans themselves who are going to have different entertainment options. They're going to walk away from the Red Sox. I mean, they, in my view, feel that no matter what, the stands are going to be full, and you know, the beer is going to be drunk and the merchandise is going to be purchased. And that is not always the case. I mean, we're seeing signs that the baseball marketplace is diminishing. And the Red Sox, in my view, need their face of the franchise, Mookie Betts, to be there. And if you're talking about trading him for Will Myers and some prospects, that is just going to set this franchise into a place where they're going to have some difficulty retaining and keeping fans on board.
Yeah, it's been a brutal offseason, really, I mean, they come into it almost from day one saying, we are cutting payroll, and by the way, in that same breath, we are increasing ticket prices, and we're entertaining thoughts of trading Mookie Betts. We didn't really make any additions of significance in the offseason. We were already in a place where, you know, the Yankees and the Astros were ahead of us. And then to cap it all off, now they're talking about going into spring training without a manager. So I know you and I on this show, we're pretty convinced spring training is not all that important. But if you go in without a manager, just think back to all the years we've been at this point where, you know, they're talking about setting the foundation and that meeting Cora had it on the first day 2 years ago, and how important that was said to have been throughout the year. And now it's like, well, yeah, if we get to spring training and we don't have a manager, we're not going to rush into anything. It's like they've taken for granted the institution and what the institution means and how passionate the fans will be about the institution. I'm with you, though. I'm getting the sense that the passion is waning, the interest is waning, and if you trade the 27-year-old perennial MVP candidate, even if you know, you know, there's a chance he could walk in free agency, it's not the way of the Boston Red Sox to give up on a guy like that
right
before at the last second. It's just not what you do when you're in their position, when you have their resources, and when you have the at least to this point, the loyalty of their fans. That's not what you do.
This is something that the Tampa Bay Rays do.
Yep.
This is something that a small-time franchise does. A franchise like the Boston Red Sox that has one of the most marketable, engaging, and best people and best players in baseball, they do whatever it takes to resign them. And you don't trade him for a low-level all-star and some guys that may pan out. Like this is a player that you trade a low-level all-star and a bunch of prospects that may or may not pan out for. And I just think that the impact from a baseball standpoint, from a marketability standpoint, and from a financial standpoint are just so significant that I can't really believe that the franchise is entertaining this. And they continue to push it. Like every week we hear of something new. Like they're talking about trading him only if David Price is involved in it. And like it's crazy. And again, I'm not a big hyperbole, hot take, over the top type of an individual, but the impact that this will have, I don't think that they, if they're entertaining it and they're discussing in this sense, I don't really think they understand the impact that it's going to have from a long-term financial standpoint and from a baseball and legacy standpoint. You are going to see people walk away from the Red Sox, and you're going to see they think that the fans are always going to come back and the stands are always going to be filled, and that is just not necessarily the case. Look at the Yankees as an example. The Yankees don't sell out every single game. The Yankees are on the path back, but when they took a step back from championship contention, they did not, you know, see the same type of interest in the team. Certainly from a TV standpoint, the Yankees still do great, but they're also the Yankees. And in this marketplace, you're competing with three other sports franchises that are perennial championship contenders and all the other things that interest folks. And baseball is a commitment. It's a passion. And people, if they see that the Red Sox aren't that interested in them or in their team, they're not going to be all that interested in the Red Sox. And you're going to lose a generation of fans. And it has just been, again, if this offseason is punctuated with Mookie Betts being traded and the team going into spring training without a manager, which basically would signify that they're just not that interested in hiring a manager. I mean, spring training is still, you know, 3 weeks away, and they've had, you know, a week or two now. So, you know, why are they not interested in engaging in a process to find a new manager? It's all just crazy.
The timing, you know, if this was early December and you're going to the winter meetings and you go in there with the attitude like, Mookie's a free agent next year. Our early talks haven't gone anywhere. We need to rebuild our farm system. Let's listen and see what we can get. And if we get blown away, we'll consider it. If we get like two prospects we could see as cornerstones, maybe. But now you're in late January with spring training knocking on the door. And if that offer hasn't come yet, it's not coming. And then you read stories last week saying that the market for bets does not expect to diminish over the course of the season, which makes total sense because if you're trading for him at this point, you know it's a rental. And what's the difference if you invest in that rental in January or in early July? You know, Manny Machado was traded in June, I think. So I can see the logic that his value will not go down because, you know, if anything, you can play contender off contender if you want to trade him in July. And, you know, if the Red Sox, if the way it's trending turns into a mediocre season and you get to July and you haven't made any headway with the contract talks, and then you decide, like you did with John Lester in 2014, like, it's not going to work out here. We're not going anywhere this year. Let's go get something for him. I'm honestly okay with that, but don't give away the first 3 months of the season and see and just assume that you're not going to go anywhere because we've seen in the past that they're a team that can do that. And the other side of the thing that doesn't make sense to me is the David Price thing. Early in the offseason, again, with the timing, when guys like Madison Bumgarner are being signed and the pitching market is thinning out and Corey Kluber's getting traded, you look at it and you're like, wow, some people even said like David Price is becoming a bargain.
Right.
I wasn't among them. I think he stinks. I would get rid of him in a second. But still, 3 years, $30 million for a guy like that, if you look at what others are paying, if you eat like, I don't know, $10 million, $15 million, knock that down to a $75 million commitment, that's a guy you absolutely should be able to trade on his own. You should not need to toss him into a Mookie Betts deal or use Mookie Betts to get rid of that money. That doesn't make sense. He has value. They need to do a better job of A, reading the situation, and B, maximizing their value. And when I say maximize value, I don't mean trading Mookie Betts for prospects.
Yeah, I would have cut bait on Price and tried to trade him, as I mentioned at the time, last year, like in the middle of the season. That was the time to try to move away from David Price. And what it symbolizes, and again, I don't know the exact thought processes of the Red Sox organization, but with the rumors that are circulating, it seems like they don't have a plan as to what they want to do here at all. It doesn't seem like there's, you know, this is what we want for Mookie Betts, this is what we're interested in, this is how we're going to do it. I mean, it seems like it kind of, you know, fluctuates. And if you have a player of Mookie Betts' caliber, I mean, you need to set the bar for what you want. You should be in charge of negotiating. Also, they've screwed up continuously in terms of their bargaining position by saying they are going to trade Mookie Betts because it seems like they're desperate to trade Mookie Betts, which doesn't make any sense, again, because Mookie Betts means to the franchise. But they are they have killed their bargaining position because they continually make it seem like they are trying to push him out. And I don't get that either. Let's do the Hall of Fame briefly with Derek Jeter and Larry Walker going in. Roger Clemens, Curt Schilling, and Barry Bonds all do not make it. In my view, they should all make it. They should all be Hall of Famers. And, you know, Schilling being, you know, not the best person, and certainly from a journalistic perspective, things he has said about members of the media and retweeting a image of, you know, the best way to deal with a journalist was a noose. Those types of things obviously are both really, really dumb from perspective of wanting to go to the Hall of Fame and realizing that the writers are going to put you into the Hall of Fame. It's always great to antagonize the individuals that would be voting for you. And also obviously from a actual standpoint. So, but anyway, the Baseball Hall of Fame is filled with cheats, deviants, losers of all sorts and shapes and sizes. And Curt Schilling certainly fits into that mold. But the one characteristic that should matter is the fact that you're one of the greatest baseball players ever. And that's what Curt Schilling is. It's what Roger Clemens is. It's what Barry Bonds is. So they all, put Pete Rose in there too. They all belong in the Hall of Fame because they are the greatest baseball players ever.
totally agree. If I had a vote, I would put them all in. But when you think about the process and everything that goes into it, it's just so messed up. I mean, I think Larry Walker, you can make a case he's a Hall of Famer. I don't know if you can make a case that a guy who got 10% of the vote 5 years ago now deserves 77% of the vote. Like, and he hasn't played a game. I mean, nothing's changed in terms of his resume.
Yeah.
So that's where it's weird, and it's going to get weirder next year because there's almost nobody on the ballot that's worth voting for. So I think if you look at the way Schilling is trending, and then I think some guys are going to feel the need to vote for somebody. I think Schilling's getting in next year. And based on the other guys, which is like Mark Burley and Aramis Ramirez and guys like that, those are the new guys to the ballot. I think this might be the best shot for Bonds and Clemens. And if it was up to me, those three would be the class of 2021 because I think that would be representative.
Get them all out of the way. Get them all out of the way.
Look at baseball from 96 to 2004. It's like them three and Pedro Martinez. You can't tell the story of baseball without them, so I don't see the point of leaving them out of the Hall of Fame.
Well, Dave, as always, appreciate you joining us the program.
Thanks, Chris.
That is Dave D'Onofrio here on the Press Pass on KXL. Press Pass tonight presented by Douglas Learned and Garvey in this segment of the show brought to you by Riverbend Community Mental Health. This is the Press Pass here on KXL 159, 1450 and NHTalkRadio.com. Press Pass presented by Douglas Leonard and Garvey. And this segment of the show brought to you by the Concord Youth Hockey Association. Get your youngster playing hockey via ConcordYouthHockey.org. Welcome to the program right now. The head coach of the UNH Wildcats, he is Mike Souza. UNH into a big weekend with UMass, a home and home Friday and Saturday. The Wildcats at 12-9-1 overall, 6-6. In Hockey East action. Coach, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
Good. Appreciate you joining us for the show. So, kind of give us an upshot as to where things are at right now. The team's been playing pretty well. You guys have won four out of your last five games, including victories over Northeastern, Providence, nationally ranked programs at this point, but a big test, obviously, against a UMass team that is ranked number 7 in the country.
Yeah, you know, the last 3 weeks we've faced off against the number one team in our league each week. So it's there's no easy games in our league. And, you know, we've played UMass earlier in our schedule. And they're a tough team. They're good in all areas. I mean, they've got some dangerous players, and they're well-coached and well-balanced. And, you know, they come off a great season last year, you know, being a national finalist. And so our guys have done a great job all year responding to challenges, big games, and you know, really trying to establish ourselves on the road. We haven't played quite as well on the road this year, and this gives us another opportunity to go out and to prove ourselves on the road tomorrow night down at UMass.
Yeah, you beat UMass at home back in November, 3-1 in that contest. And you know, I'm curious to see, you look at the season, and you've played well against, you know, high-quality teams throughout the course of the year, but there have been little blips, you know, here and there, not being able to close out back-to-back on a weekend. You know, the two losses at Maine back in November, you mentioned on the road, things have been, you know, inconsistent for you, and you look at the loss at Army as well. I mean, it seems like there has been kind of this, as is the case generally with teams that are around 500, there's been kind of that inconsistency throughout the course of the year.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things to pinpoint that people overlook is Jackson Pearson being out of our lineup for an extended period of time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jackson's first over the boards for us in all situations. So we were going pretty good with him 5-2 when he got hurt. And then, you know, and then not having him or Philip Engrass, who they've only played together the last five games. So, you know, and where I'm going with that is both guys are two natural centermen. So, you know, Jackson quarterbacks our power play, and so you know, we hit a rough spell there for a stretch of games where we were really, you know, missed some balance in the middle of the ice, and so having those guys back is a good thing for UNH hockey. No question, there's been some games that, you know, you look back through your schedule, it's hard not to do as a coach. You try to just live in the present and kind of, you know, want your guys to have that same mindset. But it's hard not to look back at some of the games you said, oh, would have, could have.
Right.
You know, you mentioned the main weekend, especially the second night up there. You're up with inside a minute to go, and you end up not even coming out of there with a point. The Bentley game comes to mind, only giving up 13 or 14 shots, not winning. But, you know, there's also been some games where you say, you know what, hats off to the players, you know, whether it was the UMass game early, the BC game early. I mean, there's been some, it goes both ways. And, you know, without taking too much away from the teams that beat us, you know, if anything, a credit to those teams. I mean, our league has a losing record against the Atlantic League this year, and so we've contributed to that, unfortunately, with losses to Bentley and Army. And you hope, you know, come the beginning of March, that those games don't come back to bite us. But you know what? All eyes are on the future. All eyes are on Friday night. Get prepared to play a really good UMass team down there, who's really got it going pretty well this year again.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, there's a lot you can look at in retrospect, but, you know, the future is now, and there's obviously a lot of opportunity in front of you, a lot of schedule in front of you to make things happen. What leads you to believe, though, that you mentioned the injuries are obviously a key portion of it, but what leads you to believe that the opportunity is going to be taken advantage of by these guys? It feels like, you know, as you've referenced, when you have that full lineup together, this has been a really good hockey club. You've made things happen in overtime throughout the course of the season, where you're a 5-2-1. So, you know, what leads you to believe that this time is something that you're going to be able to take advantage of?
I just think that the kids have there's a great mindset within the walls of the locker room. Mm-hmm. We know that we're our own worst enemy, or we're our biggest opponent. I mean, when we're firing on all cylinders and guys are really playing their best. We talk all the time about you need to play your best individual game in order for the team to be successful, meaning, you know, if you're a guy who skates, you got to skate. If you're a guy who's physical, you got to be physical. And when we do that collectively as a group, we've been very successful. In fact, you know, you look at the results, and it's all about results. But, you know, when you watch the film, Saturday night's game, the score is a little bit misleading. I actually, you know, we were probably more pleased than disappointed with our performance. So we've carried that over to this week into practice. So, you know, as disappointed we were in losing to Providence, there was a lot of positives we took out of there. And the one thing that to answer your question in full, the one thing that I like is our guys now go into a game with the expectation that they're going to win.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we didn't have that feeling, you know, we haven't had that feeling consistently.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've had it spurts. And I think there's been a believability there going back to our very first game against Miami. But then it's been inconsistent. But I think the team's over that hump where now they say, you know, why not us tonight? Like, it doesn't matter who we play. Like, we need to expect to win. And I think that's a hurdle that teams have to get over. And there's other teams in our league that are well over it. It's one that we've struggled with, you know, the last few years. But I think the team's mindset is in a good place, and I think that's the biggest difference for our team right now.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you about next, because it feels like, you know, UNH hockey is back with the way you guys have played this year. Not fully back, but back, you know, to the point where you're going into games expecting to win regardless of who you're playing. And I think that, you know, that first weekend in November and the game against UMass, obviously all those games were at home, but I feel like that, off of the start, and really establishing that start was significant, because Boston College is Boston College. It ranked 15th at that point. Dartmouth, the rivalry game, and then UMass, knowing what that program has done over the last couple of years, beating them at home. Do you feel like that? Do you guys needed that start in order to establish yourself as a club that was going to be a winning hockey club?
Well, I certainly think it helps to beat, you know, top teams in the country. I mean, it goes without saying that does wonders for the, you know, collective confidence, you know, for the group. And that, I think that's been the case. I mean, yeah, there's certainly wins to pinpoint as to, you know, what drives that mindset, if you will. But I also think that, you know, I think just our team, the makeup of our team, you know, I look at our roster and we have a lot of, you know, we have some great leadership. But we also got some young guys that play key roles for us. And so it's a matter, you know, it's a matter of guys. You know, I look at a kid like Eric McAdams, who's played really well for us over the stretch since Christmas. He's a guy that's a junior, but missed most of last year. So he's really finding his game, which you typically see out of kids into their junior year. You know, and I look at a kid like Philip Engrass, who's new to North America. He's a sophomore on our roster, but he's really like a freshman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's never played in North America, so he's got 12, 13 games under his belt, and you're really starting to see that in his game, that maturity. And then another guy's Kohei Sato, who's got 7 or 8 goals for us, who's a junior now, too. So the ability to have those guys take a step, and then you have the natural, you know, that kind of more recognizable names, the Crookshanks, Pearsons, and Kelleher's, and Grassos, Wise, and Gildens, and those names like that. But, you know, and then Callie Erickson, who's a Swedish born defenseman, who's a freshman first. So these guys, their games are maturing, and as a result of their games maturing, I think you're seeing the team mature. And you know, part of that maturity, part of the purpose is I hate to say you lose lessons when you learn lessons when you lose.
Mm-hmm.
I just, because I don't want to lose, but the reality is you do. And I think we've experienced that, you know, with some of the losses we've had, but we've also experienced that maturation through some of our victories.
That is Mike Sizza. He's the head coach of the UNH men's hockey team, joining us here on the Press Pass. Press Pass tonight presented by Douglas Leonard and Garvey. In this segment of the show brought to you by Concord Youth Hockey. .org. You mentioned a lot of the guys, you know, there who have been standout players for this hockey club this year. I'm curious as to, you know, what you're seeing from UMass, and as you're watching them play it against them previous, what stands out, and how has that program, you know, grown over the last 5-10 years into a national championship contender and team?
Well, I'll start with the second part of your question. I think one of the reasons it's grown to a national contender is through, you know, they've done a nice job in recruiting. I mean, they were able to bring in Cale Makar, who, you know, he could go on and win the Rookie of the Year in the National Hockey League this year. They had a kid, you know, Ferraro there last year, was playing in San Jose. So right off the bat, they've had two defensemen who went right from UMass to play in the National Hockey League. But they've also been able to, you know, supplement some other roster spots with some really, really good players. I mean, I think of the team this year with, you know, they get the Zach Jones, who played on the World Junior team, and Mark Delgazzo, who's a big-time player, and then Mitchell Shafey and John Leonard come to mind. So they've done a nice job in recruiting. The school, I think, has done a really good job of embracing hockey. It's always been a sleeping giant. I think anyone that follows college hockey realizes that. I think the previous staffs haven't probably got the recognition they deserve. They've done, you know, there was spurts of them being really successful there. So it's a combination of things. I mean, you can't do it alone. You know, you need the support of as I always say, of all parties involved. It extends well beyond my office, and I'm sure Greg Carville feels the same way out at UMass, and they've done a really nice job. And so this year's team, I think, poses a lot of similar threats. I mean, the strength of their team is in their D core and their D's mobility, their D's ability to get into the offense. And really push the pace from the back end offensively. And then what they do really well is they're a really good forechecking team, and they're really aggressive with their defensemen on the forecheck. So they're allowed to establish a forecheck. They also don't use Shafey and Leonard on the same line, so then you've got to be aware of that. And just their balanced attack. And you know, they play the game the right way. Greg's a good coach. They're detailed. They're organized. And so they pose all sorts of threat. I mean, there's no secret as to why they're a top 10 team in the country. And I think, you know, what you saw here at UNH for so long is you're able to ride the wave of success from the previous year. I mean, I'm sure in their locker room, there's an expectation of winning now. And that's what, you know, we're trying to, you know, reinvigorate into our program. As anyone that's followed our program for a long period of time is, you know, Coach Jamili's teams, every, you know, whenever they played, their expectation was they were going to win. And that's something that's not every program has, and it's something that's earned. It has to be earned, and UMass has done a nice job of earning it.
Coach, appreciate your time. Best of luck against UMass this weekend. We'll talk to you again soon.
All right, thanks for your time.
All right, that is the head coach, UNH men's hockey team, Mike Sizza, joining us here on the program. UNH playing some really good hockey, and that's certainly a team worth your attention here in the great state of New Hampshire. This show presented tonight by Douglas Leonard and Garvey. That segment brought to you by the Concord Youth Hockey Association.